You're listening to episode 11 of season 5 of The Bad Apples. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and this is The Bad Apples Og GNU Linux Og and Speaks cast. In this episode, well, generally speaking, we speak of Linux and GNU and free software and all that other good stuff. In this episode, we're going to talk about torrenting, bit torrenting to transfer files from your computer to someone else's computer. Talk about the binary clock, how to read it, and seem like you're cooler than you might actually be. We'll also talk about or take some listener feedback, and we'll talk about a couple of other exciting topics as well. So let's see, the first exciting topic. Apparently, from what I've understood, there is a video editor called Lightworks, and this was owned by one company, and then it got bought by another company, and the purchasing company decided that they would open source this video editing solution. Now, I'd never heard of Lightworks. Apparently, it's an Oscar-winning platform, which, I mean, in my world means nothing, zilch. I mean, you understand that things win Oscars because things win Oscars. I mean, it's not that they actually analyze it and see that it has merit or anything like that. They decide, oh, I liked that movie. What did you use for it? Oh, Lightworks? Well, then here's an Oscar. You know, it's not that big of a deal. Now, on the other hand, Lightworks, or rather, there are a dozen proprietary video editing solutions out there. I know the big ones that everyone always talks about is Avid and Final Cut, but in real life, if you go to a post-production house, you may or may not find that they are just basically a Final Cut house or an Avid house. You might find all kinds of different solutions in their place, like little editing decks that don't really have a software on a computer. You know, they're standalone workstations. You'll find those things. You'll find editing solutions that are tied to the hardware solution. So it's got jog wheels and buttons and things like that are completely not, you know, they don't look like a computer keyboard or a mouse or a trackball. They're editing devices, and they run on, you know, they control some software that does run on top of Windows or something like that. You find lots of different things, and believe it or not, they're actually used. I mean, they really do get used. It's kind of the model I take it that a lot of places use. I mean, like, if you've got something that you've invested in at some point, and you've got people who can use it, who are trained on it, or you can train quickly on it, then you're just going to keep using that solution. And it doesn't matter how hip and fashionable it is to switch to such and such a platform. If it works and gets the thing edited in the format that you want it to be edited in and end up in, then that just works. And if it's already integrated into your workflow. So Lightworks, I take it, was something like this. I mean, I know that the former owner of that company seemed to sell hardware as well. So I think it was probably something that they bundled with the hardware. I'm imagining, I don't really know for sure, but that's what I'm going to guess. So I'm trying to do that so that I can equate it to something I have seen. And the things that I have seen have been, you know, really nice looking or fairly nice looking video editing solutions with a classic dark gray background. And, you know, it looks all very technical and scary. And that's not that big of a deal. You know, I mean, you can find anything that looks like that. I mean, Cinelera looks like that. The important thing is, I would imagine that if this Lightworks thing was actually used for actual production, and I'm talking about a lot of production, if that is the case, then more than likely it's got some of those things that a video editor absolutely needs in their video editing software, such as skipping to the front of a clip or getting to the end of the clip or skipping ahead just a couple of frames with a press of a button, importing things by time code in mass, relabeling things or assigning metadata to things for shot angles and kind of shots, offlining and onlining video, creating offline clips with lower resolutions, just all that other kind of stuff that a video editor is obviously going to really, really need to do. And if you don't make that easy for them, then it's not going to be as efficient. So you might be able to argue, and you can almost always argue this, I mean, that something properly developed, you know, properly mature, like Blender, I mean, you can say, well, yeah, with Blender and FFmpeg and such, you can do this. But, I mean, that's kind of a different workflow, and it's not necessarily always the workflow that a video editor is going to be looking for. So if Lightwork has all that stuff in it, then it obviously it's kind of like where the video editing needs to be as a software application. The part that I'm not seeing in any of these press releases is that it has Linux support whatsoever. So a lot of people were telling me about this, and it seems to be popping up on lots of blogs out there, Linux blogs. And I mean, that is neat, and it's open, it's going open source. I don't know what that means exactly, because if it's open source but not free, I don't know how secure I would feel about it, because yes, it is open source, but it doesn't really make it free as such. So I'd be a little bit nervous about that. And then I'm also quite perplexed as to why, I mean, yeah, it's open source, but I mean, it's, if it's going to stay Windows only, then what does that really matter to any of us? But maybe some programmer out there can simply port it over to Linux. I don't know how easy or hard that kind of stuff is. So it is exciting news, and I thank everyone for emailing me about it and pinging me in IRC and telling me about it, because I hadn't heard about it until people did start emailing me and pinging me about it. But in general, I am withholding even the smallest amount of excitement until I know more about it, because, or know more about the intentions or the destination of it, because if some random developer out there can't go in and grab the code and port it to Linux, then that's, whether it's open source or not, that does me no good. And yeah, so that would be my fear. But I think worst case scenario would be that this thing, well, worst case scenario would be that this is the last we ever hear of it. So slightly better than the worst case scenario would be that this thing isn't properly free, and it's not really all that open and all this other stuff, but we have access to the code. So if some smart Linux developers out there can look at that code and look how things are done and say, okay, so this is what a video editor is supposed to be like, and then they make a dead ringer clone of Lightwork for Linux, you know, LinuxWorks, then great. That would be fantastic, because it strikes me that part of the problem is that a lot of these video editing sort of suites out there for Linux, it strikes me that it's almost like the developers know what a video editor is supposed to look like, and it knows some of the key features it should have, but beyond that, they don't really seem to know what to do. And I guess it would be kind of neat to get together with some of those developers and say, look, this is what a video editor is supposed to have, but I'm not really sure the proper channels to do that. And such things do exist, for instance, on the Blender site, the development site. Bugs or feature requests, I guess they would be, do exist, where it says, you know, we need this functionality. So it's there, it's out there, it's just not quite happening yet. So if a Linux-centric community develops around Lightworks, whether it's for porting it or just cloning it, that could be really, really cool. So again, thanks for everyone for telling me about that one. That was something that I learned exclusively through people telling me, so that I really appreciated that. Okay, so let's talk about this BitTorrenting thing. So pretty much no matter who you are or what you are, when you hear the word torrent, usually I think our trained reaction is for red flags to just go up and little alarms to sound. We tend to think of torrenting as something that is associated with illegality and copyright infringement and things like this. This, of course, is not true, and if you strip away all of the politics from the idea of BitTorrenting, then what you have at the base layer is the low-level stuff, and that is the actual protocol or the actual code of BitTorrent, which is basically a method to transfer bits, information, from one computer to another. And the advantage of BitTorrenting is that it will send out a steady stream of data, of bits, and it is a very robust kind of thing. It will withstand lost connections, shutdowns, reboots, you know, all this other stuff. You can be seeding this file, and people can kind of dip in and grab various parts of the file at fairly random, you know, just randomly pick and choose, you know, get the bits that they can, and then on their end, on their local machine, I mean, they can drop a connection, they can reboot their computer, they can decide they're finished torrenting for that day and shut down, and then open up the computer the next day and resume, and it's just as if though it never stopped. It just keeps grabbing up, sucking in all that data, and on their machine, on their computer, on their side, it's reassembling it, puzzle piece-like. It's reassembling all this data into a solid, logical, sensible file that they can actually use. This is an advantage over things like FTP and possibly even HTTP, because of this robust style of downloadability and the ability to resume and things like that. Now, this is both true and untrue because it kind of depends on the server that we're talking about. Because when you're talking about FTP and HTTP, right, the theory there is that you are going, let's say that you, my dear listener, are going to send me, Klaatu, a file, right? You're going to send me maybe a video that you want me to edit. So traditionally, you would upload that to your server or a cloud somewhere, and then I would go in and grab that file from the server down to my computer. So that's kind of a, what is that, like a three-step process or a two-step process? It goes from your machine to the server, and it needs to get there pretty much in one go, and then it's there, it's on the server. And then I grab it from that server down to my computer. Depending on the settings, it may or may not have to be all in one go. Some servers enable HTTP download resuming or something like that, where you can use like a wget curl, whatever, and actually get the data off the server. And if the connection drops midway through, then you can reconnect. You can tell wget or curl or aria or whatever that you're using for downloading, hey, keep grabbing this file, but just kind of pick up where you left off, and it will be able to do that. Now, I've tried to get data from servers that are not set up for this, and I don't know what the setting is. I couldn't give you the flag or the config file to look into. I have no clue, but I have been on the receiving end, and I've tried to resume download, and it has not worked. So there is a variable there. Now, with BitTorrenting, the advantage is, again, that's not the case. It's just by nature of the protocol. It is a resumable and it's a sort of a piecemeal kind of thing where you can get as much as you can get in whatever order you happen to get it, and you can reassemble it on your machine, which is why, for instance, when you are torrenting, if you're getting something from a lot of different sources, you can get data from all these different places, and it doesn't really matter. And the way that it keeps track of all this, from what I understand, is the tracker file. And the tracker sort of makes sure that you're getting the bits that you're supposed to be getting from the location that you think you're supposed to be getting it from. So this, you can obviously see how this would be a good thing, is because you could, in theory, have a huge video file that you want to send me. And rather than trying to either send your file up to an FTP server somewhere, or trying to open up your, you know, punch a hole in your firewall, open up your computer as an FTP server for me to log into it and grab that file, which you may or may not want to do. Plus, it is a little bit complex, but, I mean, it can be done. Just listen to, I think, two episodes ago, I cover establishing an FTP server. But the other way would be to do the whole torrenting thing. You can also see how this would be good at some point, and I remember on Linux Cranks podcast, we had talked about this at one point. There's some company out there, and I don't remember who or what it was. It was a little bit like Netflix-y sounding, but they were apparently going to use BitTorrent technology to stream their movies so that their customers could see or download the film that they wanted quicker. So, I mean, that's, again, just kind of brilliant, because you've got services out there that are starting to really try to take advantage of this mass distribution method that is the internet, and yet they're still trying to do it through these traditional means. And then you just think, well, why not just use BitTorrent? Because this way you can grab it, and if there's someone in your area that already has it, you can grab it from them as well, and it just becomes this big collective, well, torrent of bits. Okay, so I've convinced you. You're crazy about torrenting now. You're all excited. Let's figure out how to create a torrent file. It's actually really, really simple. It's embarrassingly simple. I mean, it's so simple that it almost doesn't even deserve a segment. It's more like a comment or something. But the way to do it, you need a torrent client, of course. Lots of torrent clients out there. The one that I used to use to grab torrents back when I was using OS X was Transmission, and then when I switched to Linux, I was happy to see my old familiar Transmission. The difference being that it was actually installed by default on the distribution that I was using at the time. I forget which one, which I always found really, really amusing, that Linux distributions actually come with BitTorrent software pre-installed usually, whereas, like, you know, you're not going to see that on OS X or Windows, obviously, because of the whole controversy around the concept. But yes, sensible OSs come with this pre-installed. Now, your OS may not come with KTorrent, and KTorrent is the one that I've kind of fallen into using simply because it's got the K in front of it. So, you know, I'm using KDE a lot. I use a lot of K apps. I don't remember how I found it. I think it was pre-installed on something at one point, and I opened up a torrent file, and it said, do you want to open it with KGET or KTorrent? And I thought, oh, okay, torrent, I've never heard of that before, so I went with that. And now I kind of use it a lot for torrenting. I'm going to go over how to make a torrent file via KTorrent, but know that you can do it with lots of other clients as well. KTorrent is the only one I've done it in, so I wouldn't know where to go in, for instance, transmission or something else for this function. So anyway, KTorrent, you open that up. It should probably be empty when you open it, unless you've been using it already. But the thing that you want to do is you go to the file menu and you select New Torrent. Now, this isn't to pull in a torrent. This is to actually create a torrent file. And when you select that, it will open up a window that says File or Directory to create the torrent from. And you simply select from your file system the file itself that you wish to distribute. So let's just say that me and Gort are doing a podcast, and he decides that he wants to, and we've been recording it locally, so he's got his audio on his side, I've got my audio on my side. We need to get them together into an audio editor so that it can sound that, you know, that we're having a conversation. So he needs to send me this big WAV file that's probably like a gigabyte for 45 minutes, almost a gig. Then we need to get the file from there to here. Now, a gig these days isn't, it's almost not even that big anymore. At the same time, it is a little bit awkward because, I mean, if you've got a Dropbox account or something, well, if you've got a Dropbox account, you're using proprietary software, so that would be one drawback for some people. But if you did have a Dropbox, let's say, then you've got, you know, if you've got stuff there already, you might already be, you know, you might only have like 500 megabytes free in your Dropbox. So you could either clear stuff out and then put that file in. All these workarounds and stuff like that. So it's one of those files that's too big to email, obviously, just large enough to be a problem. This would be an ideal file for the torrent thing. So you would select that file. So let's say it's in /home/gort/audio and /gort.wave. There are lots of different options, and the options I typically stay away from because I don't know, I haven't sat around and done rigorous testing of different chunk sizes and stuff like that. So it defaults to 512 kilobytes per chunk, and so I keep it at that. You want to make sure that you do check the start feeding box, which means that you're actually going to be willingly feeding this out into you're seeding it from your computer. Now, where it's who's connecting with that seeding process, we'll talk about in a moment. You do not want this to be a private torrent. You do not want this to be a decentralized torrent. You just want to start seeding. And now you want to also assign a tracker to this torrent. Now, trackers are the files that basically, in this case, they are almost acting like a dynamic DNS kind of role. They are sort of the middleman link that can make it so that the other computer that you're going to send it to can find the file on your computer. Because if you think about it, you've got a computer, it's got ports closed off, you've got a firewall in your router probably, and it's certainly got ports closed off. So you can sit there and create a torrent and send that torrent file to your friends all you want, but if they can't get through your firewall, that's not going to really do them much good. So the tracker is a great way for you to be able to kind of utilize this system that's already in place to send and receive the little torrent requests and stuff. So a tracker you will want to use, and this does not mean that that file will appear on anyone else's site or anything. It's not like that. You're not putting it on a tracker is not listing it on a torrent site. Okay, that's a very important concept. A lot of people do not understand that because it does get a little bit confusing. But I can use a tracker at, say, well, for instance, the Pirate Bay, right? So they've got a free tracking service, and so you simply, in the little box that says trackers, you add the tracker for that the Pirate Bay offers the community, and that is http://open.tracker.thepiratebay.org/announce, and then you add that to this torrent file. So that's all that it is. You've added that URL to this torrent file, not a big deal, and now you can save this torrent file pretty much as is. You can add a comment, a couple of different things, but basically you're finished. So you save that, and you save it somewhere on your hard drive. Let's stash it in /home/gort/documents/torrents. So now we've got a gortaudio.wave.torrent or something like that, and it's just a tiny little file, you know, a couple of kilobytes, and that's our torrent file that we've just created. Now, if we went to the Pirate Bay right now and we looked for gortaudio.wave.torrent or gortaudio.wave or whatever, we would not find it on the Pirate Bay, okay? Because we have not, as the user, we have not gone to the Pirate Bay and made a listing and listed that audio file and posted that .torrent file on the Pirate Bay. So it doesn't exist on the Pirate Bay. We're just using its service, the Open Tracker, so that we can send this torrent file to friends and that they can get those bits. And that's all that that tracker does. You could actually make your own computer the tracker, but I'm going to go into that in a moment. Okay, so we've got in our documents folder, or Gort has rather, in his documents folder, this torrent folder, and then in that he's got gortaudio.wave.torrent. So all he has to do is email me. Aikatu, here is a, here's my half of the audio for the podcast, and then he attaches that torrent file to his email. I see his email, I get the torrent file, I click on it. Depending on what email client I'm using, of course, it may or may not offer to open that torrent file up in a torrenting application. It probably will, so because KDE is integrated like that. And so I click on it, or whatever, and it asks me what application I want to open it in, and I tell it either KTorrent or KGit, whatever I want to use in that moment, and it starts downloading the file. As long as Gort has his computer on with that source file in the place that he left it. So now if he deleted the file off his computer, for instance, or moved it into some other folder, there could be a huge problem. Or if he shut down for the night, he shut off his computer. Those would be issues. But we're assuming he's smarter than that, and he is, I know him. And so he leaves his computer on, he goes to bed. Before I go to bed that night, I start my little torrenting, and it just starts pulling all the bits from his computer. Now, depending on his upload speed and my download speed, this may or may not be a very, very fast or very slow process. It just kind of depends. It also depends on our wonderful, friendly ISPs and how they feel about us. If we've been torrenting all day, every day, they might be throttling our connection a little bit, or they might be a little bit miffed at us for going over some kind of quota or something. But assuming that we don't have those issues and we live in a perfect world of net neutrality, we don't have to worry about that, and so we simply, he uploads and I download, and probably in the morning I'll get up and there's the file right there on my computer. I can open it in anything, InPlayer, Audacity, whatever, listen to it and edit it, and that is that. Okay, so a couple of specifics, since we were talking about not using a tracker that someone else owns and just doing it ourselves. Now, this would be a little bit more complex, depending on how familiar you are with your firewall and your router and all these other wonderful, wonderful things. So instead of, you'd go to KTorrent, you'd go to File, you'd go to Create Torrent or New Torrent, whatever the label is, and you select the file that you want to distribute. You check the start seeding thing, so that's got a check mark by it. And then as the tracker, rather than saying open.tracker.thepiratebay.org or, tracker.legaltorrents.com or whatever, I don't really know what trackers are out there other than the Pirate Bay, because I like the Pirate Bay. But let's say we don't want to use someone else's server, maybe we're paranoid, whatever. So what I could do is make my own computer the tracker, and that would be my IP address, which before I moved out of my apartment, I had a static IP address, so I could have very easily done that. Or if I have a no IP or a dynamic DNS setting, I could put in the URL of that dynamic DNS. So if it was homeclatunet.noip.com or something like that, then I would enter that. And then I would enter the port at which this exists. That's going to depend on your firewall, pretty much. And then you do /announce. So the deal with that is that you've set these things, that you've given it this tracker, but unless you have that infrastructure in place, now you get to go fiddle around with your firewall. So remember that there's usually, or I should say frequently, a software-based firewall on your computer. And in Fedora, that is on, Firewall, I think is the name of the application, Firewall Configuration, something like that. It's a nice little GUI app that's fairly simple to configure. On something like Slackware, it's IP tables, or you could install something separate, but I think a lot of people just tend to use IP tables. That's the software firewall on your computer. Now, chances are you're behind a router, so you're going to have to sign into your router, which is usually at 192.168.0.1, or it could be like 10.0.3. 0.1. It just kind of depends on your setup. And then you're going to need to go in there and tell it to do the whole port forwarding thing, because chances are if something comes up to your router from the outside world and tries to get in, hopefully it's blocking that. So you're going to have to open up a port and then have that port direct end up at the correct port on your computer. So it's a lot of redirecting and port forwarding and stuff like that. And if you don't know how to do that, then probably you should learn. And I did do an HPR episode on that sort of thing quite some time ago, so you could start playing around with that. But also, you know, if you don't know how to do that, then it may be too soon to try to torrent straight off your box, and you should maybe just consider using a tracker that's kind of already set up to do that stuff. I'm talking about in terms of easiness. If you're trying to learn, obviously, then yeah, try to do it from your own box. See how easy it is. See if you can figure it out. And like I said, I did do like a Hacker Public Radio on the subject, not on torrenting and stuff, but on like that kind of port forwarding through the routers and stuff like that. I think it was like an SSH with X forwarding episode. So it kind of encompasses a lot. And it's not always easy, because it really depends on the router. What does it call it? Does it call it a port forward? Does it call a just a lot of different ways to do it. So you kind of have to play around with it. And I don't want to get into that, because I don't feel like that's really part of this. I personally just use the public trackers, the free trackers that these other sites offer, because I'm not torrenting anything that I'm afraid of, I guess, you know, someone somehow, I guess, tracking it back to me or something. And it's convenient. It's very convenient. That way I don't have to go messing with my firewall. So that's what I do. Now, if I'm not concerned about people finding anything on the Pirate Bay, you know, I mean, like I say, it's not on the site, it's not on the Pirate Bay. You're simply using their servers, their little tracker network, to direct your friend's computer to the actual file as it exists on your computer. It's kind of, I would almost say, a tunnel, although that might have technical implications that are not correct. So, but it's kind of that middleman. So that's BitTorrenting, and that's how to create a BitTorrent file. And yeah, like I said, it's embarrassingly easy. I mean, it's just literally ktorrent, new torrent, assign a tracker, send the .torrent file to a friend. The end. Binary clocks are kind of like all over the place in the geek community, because it's abstract and it looks really complex and it's kind of mystifying, and people figure, well, if you know how to read that, you must be super cool, super geeky. Well, I had a binary clock on my desktop just because I wanted some blinking lights. Someone had asked me about dock apps on Fluxbox, and no, I didn't use them, so I decided to look into them, and then I looked into them, and one of the options, you know, one of the dock apps out there that was available was, I think it was called WBIN, or WB Clock, or something like that. I forget the exact name, but it's a binary clock. So I have no idea how to read those things, and I had it on my desktop, and it was blinking, and that's what I wanted. Lots of little control lights flashing, you know? But then I thought to start looking at that, and amazingly, if you stare at this thing for a good, I'd say 4 hours a day for 3 months, you will figure it out. You actually just start to figure it out. That's how it happened for me. So if you really want to understand it and really want to, like, get it, then just go install a binary clock. I think a lot of it, I mean, they're pretty easy to find. I think you're going to be able to find them. I think there's even a command line version of one. I mean, they're kind of all over the place. So install it and just stare at it for 4 hours a day for 90 days. You will get it. But if you're lazy and you want it explained, then I will tell you. And it's actually, unfortunately, it's really not as complicated and mystifying as you'd think. It's actually, in a way, a bit of a cheat. So if you look at most binary clocks, a lot of them have 6 columns and 4 rows. There shouldn't really be any with more than 4 rows of lights. So up and down, you're going to see 4 dots. Across, you're going to see, you know, rows of you're going to see 6 columns. So the first 2 columns are the hour. It's the hour place. And I'm saying hour as in hour. And then the second 2 columns are the minute place. And then the last is the seconds place. So if You've got two columns. You can almost already see where this is going, probably. How many numbers are there, potentially, in the time as we measure it during the day, in the course of the day? Yeah, it's only, it goes up to like a two-digit number, and then it starts over, right? So you've got, essentially, the first column is going to be the place the tens place in our clock. The second column is going to be the ones place in our clock. Yes, it is true. That's all it is. So you've got, let's say, for instance, let's start really, really simple. Let's say it's 2 o'clock, right? So if we express that in proper decimal form, it would be 0200000, correct? Therefore, the first column in our binary clock should be 0, meaning it will be empty. It will be blank. There will be no lights lit in that first column. The next number in our decimal representation was 2, so in our binary representation, that would be the second column from the left is going to need to show us 2. So if you know binary, of course, it's going to start, well, the absence of anything is 0, and then the first dot at the bottom of the row will be the 1, and then the next place up will be 2, and then 4, and then 8. So in order to represent 2 o'clock in binary clock, we would have a blank column, and then we would have a column that has the second row up highlighted, and then we'd have blank, 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 blank. You get where I'm going? So it's literally just nothing, and then a representation of the number 2, and then nothing, because that's dead on 2 o'clock. Quite simple. Let's say it's 2:01. Okay, so we got blank column. We've got the number 2 there, so that would be the second dot up, and then we've got another blank column for the first place of the minutes column, and then we've got the number 1 in the next column, which would be the first dot, right? That would be the very bottom dot would be the 1, because that's 1, 2, 4, 8 going up. And then we would have 0 and 0 for seconds. This is very, very simple, and see, I'm saying it's not as complex as you think it is. Now, the one that looks really cool and complex are the seconds place, because that's the one obviously advancing all the time. So if we said it was, let's just mix it up a bit. Well, no, let's keep it simple. Let's say it's 2:01 and 10 seconds. Okay, so we've got zero, you know, a blank first column for our hours, and then the number 2 in that second hours column. So that would be, again, just not the first dot, but the second dot up. That would be the number. That would be 0:02. And then for our minutes, it would be a blank column and the number 1, which would be the first dot right there on the floor. And then now we're in our seconds column. Now, we said it was 10 seconds into 2:01. 10 seconds, right? So that would be 1:0 in our decimal representation of it. So we need a 1 in that first seconds column. So that's that little dot on the floor. And then a blank second column. It's very, very simple. Let's say it's 9 o'clock. Okay, well, that would be blank and then a, so it would be a dot on the floor, and then a blank dot, and then a dot. So that's the 1 and the 8 position, right, of the binary, the column. And then it would be blank column, blank column, blank column, blank column, because I didn't say any minutes or seconds. Now, really, we're only representing the clock, the single digits of a clock, in binary form, but the layout is still our old decimal system. And that's all there is to it, really. So, I mean, if it's 11 o'clock, what would it be? Well, it would simply be dot, dot, and then zero, you know, nothing, 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 nothing. So they don't actually ever go into anything very, very complex. It's simply the representation of the digits that you would put into your decimal number, except that instead of seeing a number there, you see the binary version of that number. And that's how you read a binary clock. It's that simple. So, knock yourself out. Okay, let's segue into some listener feedback. Patrick wrote me an email about his Nokia N8 something, I forget which one it was, 800 or 810, and he was saying that the screen, the touch screen, had some kind of physical, or rather a connection problem. So when you tried to do the touch screen thing, it wouldn't work, and it wasn't the touch screen itself, it was like the connection or something like that. It can't be repaired, apparently. And I don't know if he's tried to go through Nokia or what the story is, but it is something that is not working. And he was saying that he kind of got to thinking that maybe it would be an interesting project to take this internet tablet and slap some other, you know, some more Linuxy Linux on it, like meh, and put Emacs on it and do the whole Emacs speak, and literally build up this little computing device for a blind user who that could be the CPU, really. You know, I mean, what more do you need, really, when you're just doing, you know, when you're not even, you don't even need the screen at all? What requirement is there? Well, one of the requirements would be to activate Bash or Emacs, and Emacs, I guess, from login. So that would be some kind of hack on Mer involving WinBoots, rather than going to the little desktop that they've got, just go to a bash prompt, and on top of that, go into Emacs speak, and all these other things. So, I haven't booted into Mer lately, and nor have I updated Mer from the initial install. I do know that they were having some sound system issues, and I don't really know the status of that. So that could be a huge showstopper if Emacs speak cannot generate sound. Mer itself is based on Ubuntu. I've never done an Emacs speak system on Ubuntu. I've only done it on Slackware. Could it be done on Ubuntu? Well, yeah. Do I know how to? Sorta. So the answer, of course, is like yes and no. I mean, this Nokia thing could be a really, really cool device. Like, if you really, really think about what a blind user would need, you know, it's a classic thing. I mean, they don't need the monitor, right? And the Nokia in that sense, kind of perfect. I mean, it's quite potentially all the power you really need to do blind computing. By extension, it's actually perfect for a lot of people to do a lot of stuff that they do on computing. For those people who don't really use X all that much, just booting into a console on a Nokia, I mean, it's kind of a brilliant idea, you know? I mean, I thought about it, and I was like, wow, why didn't I ever think of this? I mean, once my Nokia is, you know, once I consider it deprecated, or once the touchscreen goes out or something like that, or once I just find myself not using it as much, which, I mean, I don't really anticipate anytime soon, but let's assume at some point in the future I don't use it as much, but wouldn't it be cool? I mean, if you just had, like, a keyboard and the Nokia, I mean, it's got the wireless chip in it, so you can get online. If you put Mer on there, you can boot into a console, probably. And then you can just do all your computing. And, you know, it'd be a small screen, but, I mean, it's just text, and it's not, you know, I mean, it's not like you need a whole bunch of graphics and stuff. I think it'd be a really kind of brilliant idea. I really thought that was so cool. So, it's an exciting idea, and I don't know the answer to would the Nokia be a perfect mobile computing device for a blind person, because I've never tried that. And it would be an interesting experiment, and yeah, it could be cool. I mean, it's definitely an idea. I think it's really kind of a cool idea for everyone. That's a really cool idea. I mean, can you imagine, you know, your laptop is the Nokia that you've got in your pocket because it fits in a pocket, and maybe like a little keyboard, the portable keyboard. For instance, keyboards, and I mean, I'm sure there are something similar, but I know that the Apple ones, they're really, really thin, and I think there's a Bluetooth one where it takes like maybe 4 AA batteries in the back or something, but it's super thin. You could slip that into a pocket in a backpack easily, and that would be your laptop. That would be so cool. I think they also had like charging stations or something like that for the Nokia back in the day, but I don't know if those are still around or what. That would be, it's a really cool idea. It's really, really slick. So thanks, Patrick, for getting me started on that idea. RDM, or otherwise known as random in IRC, noticed lately that the nickname Klaatu was not really being actively used by anyone in on the Freenode network. The way that this all works is that if someone's got a nickname and they've registered it, if they don't use it for, I don't know, quite some time, I think it could be like 6 months or something like that. It could be less, a lot less than that. I forget exactly. But if it falls into disuse, you can request that an admin in Freenode removes ownership over that nickname. So Random, or RDM, noticed that Klaatu had been not used in quite a while, and whatever the cutoff time was, and so he actually asked some admin people to free the nick, and so he registered the nick, and then he, when I signed in later that day, he told me that he wanted to give me the nick Klaatu, which I thought was really, really cool and really, really nice, and fairly random, but it was cool. It was really neat. So I've got the nick now, Klaatu, as well as Not Klaatu on Freenode. So if you ever see a Klaatu or a Not Klaatu, they are probably the same person, and they are probably me. So thanks, Random. That was, like I say, kind of random and unexpected, but really, really appreciated. Well, let's just talk about the last episode, the most recent one, interview with Chess Griffin. The sound quality was not perfect on that, and Chess wanted to blame his cell phone, and I told him that it wasn't his cell phone. It was the little wire tap that I was using. It just did not work. It was not up to the task. And to that end, I have since gotten a different phone entirely, just completely ripped out the old system and swapped in a new one. So I'm hoping that's going to improve sound quality for me, for any future interviews, for all the other shows that I'm on. Just all around, it should be a lot better. So I think that problem has been fixed. Having said that, the sound quality, I guess, wasn't unlistenable, because a lot of people have said that they really enjoyed the episode. I know that I enjoyed it. I really enjoy talking with Chess when I do talk to him. And, you know, I think there's already a little bit of, like, almost a legend around him among a lot of us little podcast nerds. So I don't want to add to that, but I will simply say that the projects that he's been working on have really, really been cool. And, you know, I mean, the guy did a great show, Linux Reality, and he's doing a lot of cool software now. And it's neat. You know, it's really cool. And this is why I like the GNU, Linux, and open source philosophy, or the ecosystem, or whatever. I mean, it's a place where you can actually just kind of talk to the people doing all these cool things that you use every day. And I've said it before, and I will say it again, and this is the simple truth. This kind of fulfilling interaction that you can have with the developers of the software that you use. I mean, I can't say enough, again, just to emphasize, how SBO Package has just kind of like, it's just really, really upgraded the Slackware experience for me, and it's made distributing how-tos on, you know, multimedia stuff, like with what I'm doing with Slacker Media, which is slackermedia.info, just a lot easier. So there's this. There is that thing, and it is made possible by SBO Package, and yet SBO Package is made by, like, this guy who I can talk to at any time I want to. I can email him. You know, he might be busy, he might not be, whatever, but he's accessible. So this same fulfilling experience and this same kind of feeling of, you mean I can actually talk to that person and they might actually, they'll probably email me back, or at least I can feel sure that they got the email and read it and will eventually email me back, or whatever the case may be. You've got this kind of interaction. You can have that with a lot of other things in life as well. And this is the very reason that I've actually stopped listening to most what I would call commercial music. And when I told my friends that, they kind of laughed and told me that, what was I talking about? I didn't listen to commercial music anyway. And so I'm not going to go into that, because it's a completely different topic. But my point is that I've been listening to a lot of music, for instance, lately, that certain criteria have to be met. And one of those is that, can I talk to the artist? You know, have I met them? Can I contact them and actually interact with them on a personal level, rather than this kind of, you know, oh, you can't speak to the artist, you must speak to their agent. And the agent will deem if you are important enough to ever speak to the artist. Or you can send the artist a fan mail, you know, whatever fan mail is. You can send them a fan mail, and it will go into this bin of dark, you know, messages into which they may or may not dip. It's just, I mean, it's so, well, what, pretentious or something, or elitist or something. I don't really know the right word, but it's just so separate. You know, it's so impersonal and everything. So my point being, I guess, that somehow this whole free software movement, this kind of this niche, and maybe that is why it's so personal, because it is really a niche. But at the same time, it's also because it's a lot of normal people doing stuff, and we're all normal people, and we can talk to normal people. We don't have fear of normal people. And keeping people normal is a really great way to keep people more or less normal, like honest, you know, like down to earth, as well as keeping them accessible and keeping them in touch with other people and keeping us all in touch with each other and forming a community that you just don't have around a lot of other things in our lives right now that we're supposed to really just buy into, like literally buy into. It's a commercial enterprise, whereas GNU Linux is not so much that. And there's a lot of cases where you can simply email someone and ask them a question, or say, hey, I really liked that wallpaper that I downloaded from that site that you did, or wow, I really like, you know, this new application launcher that you're developing, or this application, or whatever the case may be. So somehow I equate all of that to the previous episode. Baba Gao is someone, I think, from Greece, and he emailed me, well, he or she, I'm not really sure, Baba Gao emailed me and said that he or she was attempting to use Linux for music recording and stuff, which is always interesting because, I mean, it's a real trick doing that sometimes. And apparently a tutorial on Qtractor that I'd done, you know, for this show and everything, had come up in an internet search for, you know, music and Linux or something like that. I've gotten a couple of different emails from people now about an older version of Qtractor, or a version of Qtractor that was compiled with such and such support not included, and things like that. So I will say again, and I will continue to say, that sometimes, especially for those really, really important applications, compiling it yourself is simply the best way to go. And here is what I was talking to Gort about with this, because we were talking about this kind of thing. It was interesting because he was on OS X, and I was trying to get him into Fink and stuff like that. And we started talking about the way that packages are distributed. In the end, I was telling him how, again, straight from like Dan Washko's blog, basically, that source code is simply the purest and, I think, most effective way of distributing a program. Now, keeping in mind that I'm not a programmer still, but keeping in mind also that I said effective and not efficient, because there's a difference. The most efficient way to distribute software package might be more like a binary that will run on, you know, a big fat binary with lots of library files that are all bundled together into some kind of self-contained directory, you know. I mean, that would be one way of doing it, in theory, and you hear about different projects that kind of do this kind of thing. And that's nice, and that's great, and it's very efficient, because then someone literally would drag it onto their computer, they would double-click on it, it would launch, and that would be the end of the story. But in terms of it being truly effective, to where you get the application and you compile it for your computer, and you know what exactly is included, what support is included, what is not included, things like that, source code is where it's at, because that is a universal thing. You send the source code and you can compile it and then run it. Variation on that theme, of course, or the problem with that is, of course, where you need to actually port the code. So that's a completely different issue, and that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking simply about, I know that this software package was written for GNU Linux, and so I'm going to take it and I'm going to compile it on my computer. I'm going to verify what dependencies there are, and then I'm going to sit there and compile it, and then I'm going to run it. And that really, really seems to work a lot. And I'm not saying that it's that easy and that there's never a problem and what's wrong with you, why don't you just compile all your software. I'm not saying that at all, because I know better. I do. I know that sometimes you try to compile something and there's some mysterious error that you simply don't understand, because maybe it's just really complex, or maybe it's something's wrong with the code, or maybe you just simply haven't compiled enough software yet to get used to, oh, there's this error, obviously that means I need to go find such and such a library, or I need to really, really hack it and symlink it to some other library, which apparently you're never supposed to do, but I do anyway. All these other kinds of things that you just can't understand, except that you can eventually. So it's kind of an interesting issue, and it's an interesting dichotomy of there being this universal format of source code, and also it being a little bit of a learning curve to really get into the whole source code thing. However, there's a lot to say for it, you know, and one of those things is that when you go and you've got an Ubuntu CD, I understand the necessity for a new user to be able to put Ubuntu in there to their computer and get everything working. I mean, that was my measure of a good distribution when I very, very first started. I knew that Slackware was supposed to be good, but in terms of me getting my school papers done, not on Mac OS X, it was not going to happen on Slackware. And so booting into Ubuntu and being able to use it and have everything just work, that was a big, big deal. And that is a big deal for a lot of people, and justly so. I mean, there's that side of computing, obviously. And there's also that side of getting away from your proprietary OS. If you want to get off the proprietary OS and live in Linux, but still be able to get your work done, you have to kind of make some, you know, you have to go to the easier ones first sometimes. So, having said all that, you know, it's really great to be able to have that and to have the distro go into the computer and make everything work, and you don't really have to think about much after that. That's great. The problem with that is when you start getting into the more complex computery kind of things where you're using QTractor or some kind of, you know, maybe Blender with an FFmpeg thing that you're trying to do. How did Ubuntu compile that software? You know, what are they doing behind the scenes? What are they not doing behind the scenes? What's their sound system like? Are they using Pulse? Are they not using Pulse? What's going on? And that's where it starts to get pretty difficult to, you can almost no longer say it just works, you know, it's so easy, because there are so many variables and there are so many different ways of doing things on Linux. There's no moral there, it's just an analysis. That's something to keep in mind. So if you are doing, for instance, if you want to start with music or video or something on Linux and you're running into problems, keep in mind that the distribution that you're using may be making things very easy for certain situations, and it may be kind of almost hindering you in others. So there's that. There is that. So let's see, what else is there? Well, Doru wrote me from Romania and told me that the Speaks feed entry for the Bad Apples on episode 9, season 5, linked to the AUG version instead of the Speaks version. They managed to find the episode anyway. They were able to, you know, figure out my naming scheme and everything like that, so no problem, but I did fix that, and everything should be fine now. All the Speaks episodes have moved, but you won't be affected by it. I've updated all the links and everything like that, so don't worry. But it is now on augcastplanet.org/notblog/audiophile or something like that, so just FYI. Doru also said that the quality versus the file size of my shows has been appreciated, meaning that Doru likes that I'm not doing the whole big, really nice-sounding podcasts, and that I'm doing a pretty darn good-sounding podcast, but compressed really, really, really small. I have to absolutely agree. I almost want to go back to all the former seasons and re-encode them to much, much smaller sizes, but I'm not going to do that, because that would be a great way to waste a lot of time. But I do think that, yeah, the small file sizes are definitely working. The uploading and the downloading of them is just, it's really, really nice. I'm really liking it, and I've gotten a lot of good feedback about it, so I'm going to assume I think we're all pretty happy with that. Okay, I think that's about as much I can fit into this episode without just going on and on and on. So thanks, everyone, for emailing me. I hope that I am answering everyone. I'm certainly intending to. So thank you for listening. Thank you for emailing. And yes, I will be at Southeast Linux Fest, and I will be talking. I was accepted. The talk that I pitched was accepted. It's about building a multimedia system on Linux, specifically centered around Slackware, of course. It should be a good talk, so please try to attend if you're going to be at Southeast Linux Fest. And if you see me walking around, I'm the guy with blue hair. You can just, you know, say hi, because I'm really nice, actually. And if I don't talk to you, it's not because I don't like you or something. It's just because I'm shy or something, because sometimes I get into these sort of shy moods or whatever. But typically, I try to be friendly. So, yeah, say hi to me and show up at Self. Self is a great, great, great fest. I cannot say enough positive things about Southeast Linux Fest. It is a fantastic little show, and you should probably register now and get your hotel and everything, because slots are gonna disappear eventually, and prices are going to go up and all that other stuff. So start making the plans now if you do intend to go. Of course, this has been the Bad Apples, episode 11 of season 5. I've been Klaatu, and you can certainly hit me up by email at klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org or klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can visit the website at klaatu.hackerpublicradio.org. You can, let's see, what else? Oh yeah, you can find me on irc.freenode.net as Klaatu and as not Klaatu. Either one of those are good. You can also, of course, IM me at notklaatu@jabber.org. Thanks for listening, and I will see you next time.